You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Sabrina Fulton and Tracy Martin have written a book called Rest in Power, The Enduring Life of Trayvon Martin, about their relationship with their son, his death, the court case, and his legacy. It's published by Spiegel & Grau, and I'm very pleased it has brought Sabrina Fulton and Tracy Martin to our show today. Hello.
Hello. How are you?
Good morning.
Did you feel that there was a story to be told that hadn't been told in all of the news coverage? Is that one of the reasons you wrote this book?
We basically felt that the news just did like headlines and like a quick summary. And so we wanted to give our account of what we experienced as parents of Trayvon Martin. We feel like we were the best persons to speak for him since he's not here. And so who better than his parents?
How old would he be today?
He'd be
22. On February 5th.
February 5th, yes.
And you've chosen to tell this story in alternating chapters, each of you writing a chapter?
Yes, because we felt like if it was a book all about me or all about Tracy, instead we decided to write alternating chapters so that the reader could see both parents' side of view.
I thought it was because you divorced some years ago. Sabrina, you've said that your name has been both a blessing and a curse. In what way?
Because every time I tell people my name, Sabrina, they always spell it S-A-B-R-I-N-A.
And it's spelled S-Y-B.
It's spelled S-Y, so it's different. I feel like I'm different because I'm a blessing.
Now, is that one of the reasons you chose to name your son Trayvon?
No, I think that was just particularly. I didn't want to have a junior, but I wanted his name to be kind of close to my name, and so that's why we chose Trayvon.
Instead of Tracy.
Yes.
You were born in Miami, but raised in East St. Louis?
Correct.
What was life like there? The East St. Louis is a largely African-American town.
Correct. Life growing up, it was good. It was good. It was 99.9% African-American. And growing up was tough there. I grew up in a single-parent home, but my mom worked several jobs to provide for me and my brothers, and she taught us, she instilled some great values in us as young men. And
did she give you the talk?
Oh, she always gave us the talk.
About racism?
About racism, because we had surrounding cities around East St. Louis that were predominantly white. And, you know, back in the 70s and 80s, racism was still alive and showing. And so by being from East St. Louis, we used to be in certain areas, and we would get called out our names and even chased at times.
And you gave Trayvon that speech?
Correct. We just let him know, and not saying that Trayvon grew up in that same era, whereas he would get chased in his own neighborhood, but just knowing that what we had been through as young men, young African-American men, that it would be a possibility that that could happen.
Sabrina, you write that Trayvon was a mama's boy.
Absolutely.
In what way?
He was so close to me. We were very close. You know, you have little girls that are daddy's girls, and then you have boys that are mama's boys. So my boys are definitely mama's boys.
He went to a couple of different high schools. Why did he transfer?
Well, I transferred him from one school to another school. Even though he liked Miami Carroll City, I transferred him to Dr. Michael Kropp because I thought it was a better school. And they gave schools grades at that time, and Dr. Kropp got a better grade. And so I just felt like he needed a change. He was transitioning from kind of the little boy to the kind of a teenager, and I just thought that he needed a change, and I changed the schools.
And you say the problem started to arise at the start of his 11th grade school year.
Correct.
That's what was happening.
That was right when I changed the school. At the other school, he was there with a lot of his friends and everything. And so I know there was an adjustment where he had to make new friends. I know that. And because he would tell me he didn't know that many people there. And I'm like, you know, you can make friends. I mean, he was a friendly person. He was a people person. So I just felt like he could make new friends. And eventually he did, you know, some good friends, some bad friends. But, you know, nevertheless,
that's what high school is.
Right, right. He had to pick and choose and decide which ones were going to be, you know, beneficial for him. So I changed schools because I felt it was a better school.
Tracy, are you tired of telling the story about how he saved your life from an accident in your apartment?
You know, as a father, you never get tired of telling that story. That's something because that's definitely a proud moment that I remember from him. And the sad part about it is that I wasn't there to save his life. And so I never get tired of telling that story because it just reminds me that how grounded we are in this fight for him. And so,
there was a fire and he pretty much saved your life.
Yeah, he pretty much, unable to get out of the fire because of the grease had burned my lower extremities. And I called and called him and called him, and he finally woke up. And he pulled me out of the kitchen and went back in and retrieved a phone and called 911. And that had to be that just showed who he was as a child.
And how are you? Have you recovered completely from the burns?
Yes, I've recovered here before.
My guests are Tracy Martin and Sabrina Fulton, the parents of Trayvon Martin. They have co-authored a book called Rest in Power, a parent's story of love and justice and the birth of a movement. Why rest in power?
I think that it speaks for itself, that we know that Trayvon is resting in peace, but look at everything that's going on behind his name. Look at his legacy. Look at the movements that his name has sparked. And so it's a lot of power behind Trayvon's death. And it's a fight. It's a fight for justice. And so Rest in Power is definitely a name that we feel proud of.
Now, why do you think that the reaction to what happened here was more powerful than similar incidents in the past?
I think people were just a little sick and tired. I believe that since Emmett Till and maybe before some others, that people just continue to hear about African-American young men and women being shot and killed and nobody does anything about it. And I think when this happened with Trayvon, I think that was the last straw for a lot of people. And instead of just complaining about it, they wanted to do something about it. And so I think that's why so many people, you know, they just could not understand, just like we couldn't understand why you had a 17-year-old that was unarmed. You had a 28-year-old man with a loaded gun. How could that possibly be any comparison? And so I think that's the reason why so many people were involved. They were just sick and tired of the same thing continuing to happen, and that's why they came out to rallies and protests, and so many people got involved.
Tracy, why did Trayvon come to visit you on that week in February?
Well, he wasn't visiting me. I live in Miami.
Goes from one very the two homes at different times.
No, he was living with Sabrina actually. Mm-hmm. And of course, he had the luxury of spending time with either of us anytime he wanted to. But at the time, he had been suspended for school, and so I was going to Orlando that weekend. And I wanted him to just, as you know, I didn't want him to sit at home. My friend was living in Orlando at the time, and so we decided to send Trayvon up to, you know, he was out of school. We didn't want him to just be sitting at home doing nothing.
And then he wasn't there. He could have just been out. When did you realize that this was going to be a serious problem? Did you think about filing a missing persons report?
Well, he had not just been. I mean, he was up there more than one day. He was up there for he had been up there for almost 3 or 4 days at the time that this incident happened, and so that Saturday night when we last spoke, he called and asked. I called and asked him, did he have enough money to get him some pizza? And he had enough money. And so when we returned to the home Saturday night, Trayvon wasn't there. Sunday night, Trayvon wasn't there. And so I made a few phone calls, and his phone kept going to voicemail. I called my nephew's phone. It was going to voicemail, so I thought they were in the movies because that was a plan that they had early in the day. And so it got late, and I laid down. And when I woke up, I searched for him, and he still wasn't there. So that's when I started calling the emergency numbers, trying to find him.
And when the police told you what happened to your son, you say that you knew the killer wasn't black. Why?
I didn't reference that the killer wasn't black. I know who the killer was at that time.
They already told you that it was George Zimmerman.
No, they hadn't told me at that time. What was told to me was that it had been an incident which occurred, and the individual was a white Hispanic male, and they didn't know what the particulars of the incident.
Sabrina, what were you doing when you learned what had happened to your son?
I was at work. I was at work, and when Tracy initially called me and told me that something had happened, but he didn't know what it was, and so I left work and went downstairs, and I was in my car when he actually called back to tell me what the detective had said.
And then later on, you said that you found strength in the lyrics of a song that was made famous by the Mississippi Mass Choir, Your Grace and Mercy.
Yes.
So that was the lyrics of a gospel song come to you in moments of stress?
Well, I needed something. I was by myself, and I needed something, and that's all I could think of.
You and Tracy identified Trayvon at the police station, but why hadn't the police taken George Zimmerman into custody yet? Why wasn't he arrested, although he'd admitted to having killed Trayvon?
Well, I initially identified Trayvon through photos at the house, and later on we went to the police department just to find out what happened. And so that whole day, we were told, after I identified him, they say that they were going to send the information over to the medical examiner's office in Volusia County. And so I just wanted to, it was strange to me, Volusia County, that the detective decided to drive the information over to Volusia County when he could have easily just faxed the information over. And so I thought that was kind of strange. And
do you ever find out why that was?
I really didn't find out where it was. And there really wasn't a reason for him to drive that information 45 minutes away when he could have easily just faxed it.
My guests are Tracy Martin and Sabrina Fulton, co-authors of Rest in Power, A Parent's Story of Love and Justice and the Birth of a Movement, The Enduring Life of Trayvon Martin. It is published by Spiegel and Grau. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Sabrina Fulton and Tracy Martin, who have co-authored a book about their son called Rest in Power, The Enduring Life of Trayvon Martin. It is published by Spiegel and Grau. Tracy, you say that your lawyer, Benjamin Crump, had trouble getting the police to release the tapes of the 911 phone calls on February 26th. Why was that?
I think they were just trying. They didn't want the 911 tapes released because they didn't, it wasn't collaborating with the story that they were giving us, that the police department was giving us. It just didn't add up. And so we had to actually file a lawsuit against the city of Sanford to get the tapes released.
Did you have the feeling they were protecting George Zimmerman?
Yes, definitely. We felt from the beginning that they were trying to protect the killer of our son. And it was stated at night that the detective had some type of contact with the state attorney as well as the killer of our son's father.
You mentioned that you didn't want Trayvon's death to be a race issue. How did you want it to be perceived?
Well, we just wanted it to be perceived as an issue, an injustice issue, a wrong issue, and initially we continued to say that this wasn't about race, it wasn't about black and white, it was about right and wrong, but the longer the story played out, the more it became evident that race was an issue.
Well, the way the police, the Sanford police, were relating to you, the withholding information, for example, about George Zimmerman having a police record, wouldn't that suggest that there was a racial component in it?
Yeah, I thought it was. At first, they initially said that the individual had no record, that his record was squeaky clean, and then just to find out through a news source that he had multiple incidents and run-ins with the law. I think that was a part of deception that played a part, huge part.
Now, who's Kevin Cunningham, and what role did he play in pushing for the arrest of George Zimmerman?
I think Kevin Cunningham was the young man that started
change.org.
He's the young man that started change.org, the online petition to get the individual responsible for our son's death arrested.
And then the two of you decided that you would use the media as a platform to tell Trayvon's story. Otherwise, might the story just have been swept under the rug?
Absolutely. When Tracy encountered so many problems with trying to get information for a minor from the police department, Sanford Police Department, and then had problems at the medical examiners, we just encountered so many problems in different angles. I decided that I would not go to Sanford. I didn't want to go to Sanford. I didn't want to go to the Orlando area, period. I was just like, you know, let me grieve here. Let me just bring the body back and we'll have a service for him. But when I got a call from Tracy and one of our attorneys, Attorney Crump, said that they were not going to arrest the person that shot and killed. They have the gun. You have the person. You know practically what happened, the scene and everything. Why? And they had no answers. And so that particular night, I packed up my things and I was headed to Sanford. We had a meeting that evening when I got to Sanford, and they were like, listen, they're not going to arrest him. They're not going to arrest him. And we knew then that we could not, you know, have this tragedy swept under the rug, and that we needed to reach out to different media outlets. But let me just say, it wasn't the larger industries that really started the movement. It was the young folks.
Who started the protest, right?
Right. It was the colleges and universities that put things on social media to make the fire start, and that's how it started. And then the cable channels picked it up, and then the bigger channels picked it up. But it was the college students that actually started the movement.
And then there were some prominent figures that helped you get the 911 tapes released.
I think that was due to the pressure that Attorney Crump was applying to the city of Sanford. There really weren't any reason why they should have held the tapes. And the mayor made a conscious decision to release the tapes. And he went against the advice of his constituents.
It was pointed out that Trayvon had a hoodie on, and I don't know why that was made into a big thing, but who organized the Million Hoodie March?
I think it was the grassroots movement, Daniel Marie, and he organized it here in New York. We knew that they were going to have a rally when we came to New York, but we didn't know on what scale. And we walked into when we walked out into Union Square, I think that it took us by surprise.
Were you surprised when President Obama gave his speech?
Uh, I wouldn't say I was surprised, because as a father, you just see the compassion in President Barack Obama's personality. And so just knowing that he too was a father, and he felt the compassion of parents, and just to mention Trayvon's name in the White House, it meant a great deal to us.
And then Michael Skolnick comes into the story. Who is he?
Michael Skolnick at the time was an advisor for Russell Simmons. He ran Global Grind, which is a social media network. And Michael Skolnick has definitely been on board with our movement. He's helped us in so many different ways, and he's responsible for really just keeping it in the forefront.
And Black Lives Matter grew out of this?
Black Lives Matter actually, Black Lives Matter actually has their own, it's a different entity, but it did grow from the Trayvon Martin movement.
Are you surprised that Black Lives Matter has become so controversial? So many people cite it in a negative way.
I'm not surprised. People don't quite understand what it's all about. That is not African Americans, or that is not a group of people saying anything negative about another group. What it is saying is, my life matters. It's so many African American men and women that have been killed by senseless gun violence, and have been killed by chokeholds, and have been killed by, strangulation, and just different things that we feel that other people don't feel like our lives matter just as much as theirs matter. And so that's why Black Lives Matter is so important, because we want to bring that particular issue to the forefront, that we matter too.
When you look at the acronym, and there are certainly people that say all lives matter, and we do agree with that. But when we say Black Lives Matter, you have to look at who's the police brutality, who has the police brutality issues, or who has the issues with being shot with your hands up or walking away from the police. Those are Black lives that are getting taken away like that. There's no other ethnicity group that's getting taken away like that. So when we say Black Lives Matter, it's our life matters. So don't shoot me when my hands are on the dashboard, or don't shoot me when I'm walking away with my hands up.
My guests are Sabrina Fulton and Tracy Martin. They have co-authored a book, Rest in Power, A Parent's Story of Love and Justice and Birth of a Movement, The Enduring Life of Trayvon Martin. It is published by Spiegel and Grau. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Why did you decide to look at Trayvon's call records? How helpful would that have been for your case?
I just think that, as a father, I just wanted to know who was the last person that he was talking to. We know that he was on the phone a lot. I needed to know the last person he talked to, how long he was on the phone, and that kind of gave us a sense of what he was doing at the time of his death. It just dawned on me. It was no particular reason why I looked at my cell phone bill, but I just needed to know who was he talking to at the time of death. What was he doing? And we found answers that were very helpful to us as a family. Because, it started to put a little light on what was going on.
When did George Zimmerman turn himself in? Hadn't he tried to go into hiding?
Yeah, he did go into hiding. He didn't. He never turned himself in. It was after the state attorney decided to file charges against him that he was arrested.
And so, Sabrina, you wrote that your attorney said the Stand Your Gun, Your Ground law would not be used as a defense. Were you surprised when that changed as the
Absolutely,
trial progressed?
Because we had heard that term from the time the situation happened, which was February 2012. We had heard that term, that's what the defense would be using, the Stand Your Ground. And then That was in 2012. And then it wasn't until 2013 that we found out, in April of 2013, that we found out that they would not try to use that as a defense. And so...
But it didn't seem to really apply. A boy walking down the street, a man in a car with a gun, he comes out. You would think that Trayvon's case would have...
Absolutely.
He would have been seen as the victim, not as the threat.
Right. I mean, through normal eyes, that would have happened. Trayvon would have been the person that was standing their grounds and not George Zimmerman. But in other people's eyes, you know, people see what they want to see. They perceive what they want to perceive. But at the same time, Trayvon was simply walking back from the store with a drink and some candy. No weapon, not committing any crime.
When George Zimmerman was being cross-examined by Bernie de la Rionda, did you feel, Tracy, that the questions he asked helped your case?
No, I don't think that they asked the right questions. They never asked him what was his motive for even getting out of the vehicle if he felt threatened for his life. If I feel threatened for my life, I'm going to eliminate myself from the equation and not get out the vehicle to see what's going on. And I just had a problem with a person feel that their life was in danger when you get out with a loaded gun.
Sabrina, didn't Judge Kenneth Lester Jr. learn later that George Zimmerman's mother, Shelley, lied about certain information in the court?
No, that was his wife. Shelley was his wife, not his mother.
She perjured herself?
Yes.
So what was that information?
The information was about a passport or some money. I don't remember exactly what it was, but it was about one of the two things that she lied about, and they listened on a videotape, and she committed perjury.
But she was never
punished. Tracy, no, nothing was never done.
And Tracy, you say that 6 weeks later, they replaced the judge. Why did that happen?
Judge Lester was taken off to the case. It had something to do with the prosecutors. They wanted Judge Lester off the case. I personally felt that they saw that Judge Lester was a no-nonsense judge. And they did everything that they could do to get him removed from the case.
So did they feel that the next judge, Deborah Nelson, would help them?
I can't say that they felt that Judge Nelson would help them, but I do feel as though Judge Nelson let them get away with so many different things. I mean, Trayvon was the victim, and he was put on trial. It went so far as... the defense attorney brought in a slab of concrete and said that was the weapon that Trayvon used. And so I just don't think Judge Lester would have let that. It was a mockery. They made a mockery of Florida law.
Didn't Zimmerman's lawyer, Mark O'Mara, call you up to the witness stand, Sabrina? Why?
Yes.
What evidence could you have given? You weren't a witness.
I have no clue.
What kinds of questions did they ask you?
I don't remember.
They also brought the last person who spoke to Trayvon, Rachel Jingtall, to the witness stand. Did the way she was cross-examined help or hurt the case?
I just think that, and I hate to keep saying this, but the state of Florida, they really weren't prepared. You know that you have a teenage young lady that you're going to put on the stand and that she's going to be cross-examined by experts. And you just don't prepare her for what's in store.
So when did you start to feel that the trial was turning against your son?
In all honesty, we tried to have faith in the judicial system. But from the beginning, we knew that our hands were tied. We knew that when I heard a statement from a potential juror that said, that Trayvon would have never been in the situation that he was in had I been involved in his life, I knew that our hands were tied. I knew that these jurors had had they already formulated their own opinion about who I was, about who Sabrina was, about who Trayvon was.
Wait. So if you'd been more involved in your son's life, he wouldn't have been walking down the street?
Correct.
With a can of soda? Was it soda?
That would, a can of iced tea. But that's the perception that the jurors had. And why
didn't the prosecutors call you to the stand?
I have no idea. We asked several occasions, you know, to call character witnesses. Who best to be a character witness for a deceased minor than his parents?
Sabrina, can you talk about the Trayvon Martin Foundation? Is the program starting to accomplish the goals that you set for it?
Yes, we still are a fairly new organization, but we do have programs that we are very proud of. Most recently, in the next few weeks, on February the 11th, the foundation celebrates Trayvon's birth and not his death. So we know that the media usually celebrates his death, which is at the end of February, but his birthday was February 5th, and so he'll be 22 years old.
And
on February 11th, we have a short walk. It's a what we call a peace walk, and that's exactly what Trayvon was doing. And we let our young people, and we let the world know, we let our local leaders know that you have a right to walk in peace without being followed, chased, profiled, or murdered. And so at the end of that walk is a short distance. At the end of the walk is a peace talk. And at that peace talk, we have our community to come out to speak with our young people, to bridge the gap between law enforcement and our young people. But it's a really awesome event. We ask everybody to come out. It's not just a local event. We ask people from all over the United States to come out and wear the shirt, wear whoever loved one you're supporting, because this is not just about Trayvon. This is about all kids who are victims of senseless gun violence, and even the Trayvon Martins that have not been shot and killed.
Have you found the writing of this book and then talking to people like me and others cathartic in any way? Does this help at all?
I think that it's been therapeutic, but we don't want to get this writing this book as being therapeutic confused with this as being a healing process for us, because it hasn't, because we relive the story so much. This book, as I said, is therapeutic. It's very informative. It's for the most part, it's inspirational to those people that have lost loved ones and don't know where to turn, don't know where to go. So this book means a lot to us, and you know, we invested a great deal of time in this book. It's great. It's a great read, and it's just a tribute to who we are and who our son is.
And Sabrina, you've also have created a gathering called the Circle of Mothers.
Circle of Mothers is my signature event. That's an event where I bring mothers from all over the United States, because I understand that we heal differently from fathers. And so I've had Sandra Bland's mom, Eric Garner's mom, Tamar Rice's mom, Mike Brown's mom.
Amadou Diallo.
Yeah, Amadou Diallo's mom.
So you're going
mom,
even back a bit.
Oscar Grant's mom. Yeah. Jordan Davis' mom, Dante Hamilton's mom. I mean, I just really bring all of these moms together because I want us to heal together. I want us to empower one another. And then my ultimate goal is for them to go back in their community and help another mother.
I thank you both so much for being on our show today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sabrina Fulton and Tracy Martin, Rest in Power, Parents' Story of Love and Justice and the Birth of a Movement, The Enduring Life of Trayvon Martin. It is published by Spiegel & Grau.